Good morning. This is Tracy Hales-Vass with Right on Four Corners. Today, I'm talking to Michelle Buchanan, the author of Scotta's Harp. Good morning, Michelle.
I'm so pleased to have this interview. I can't tell you how pleased I am.
Well, I really appreciate reading your book and the stories that you've told in it.
Thank you. Were you able to finish it?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, I wasn't sure. It's rather long, 460-odd pages.
It is, but all of it's very interesting. Why don't you tell the listeners about the book?
Well, this book is actually a history of the Scottish Stone of Scon, and the woman who is the namesake of Scotland, her name was Scota or Scotach, and she actually was an Egyptian princess who evidently emigrated from Egypt area across the Mediterranean, went to Spain and then Ireland, and then her family, or whatever was left of her family, emigrated to Scotland later, and those are the Scotti. It is a compilation of about a dozen myths, mm-hmm. and I researched this book for a good 20 years to make sure I had everything in there that I wanted to say.
Yes.
But it's basically how harps came to Ireland and, of course, the British Isles. And also a lot of very odd history that has not been uncovered.
But there are other stories in here. I mean, there is the main story of Scotta, but there's also a few little quips of more modern. And then there's a longer story set in 1996.
Yes, well, I had to have a present-day Egyptologist tell this story so that it didn't sound like, just a dump of information. I wanted to have an American protagonist who is Donnie Cameron.
Yes.
And he is an Egyptologist who is not very smart about the ways of the world. He actually gets sucked into these unscrupulous treasure hunters.
Yes.
And, of course, he meets a serious end.
Yes, he does.
But, it all comes out in the end. I have been to Scotland to look at that Stone of Scon, and I can tell you it's a very lumpy piece of sandstone that no king would want to sit on to be coronated on. In 96, Donnie Cameron is excavating some things in Spain, and he comes upon the records of Scota and her husband Gamal Melev, mm-hmm. that were there in Spain. And, of course, these artifacts are going to be sold to unscrupulous buyers. And he travels all around. He eventually winds up in Ireland and then Scotland. And, of mm-hmm. course, it's a long, long story.
It is. But because you break it up with other stories, it's very readable.
Oh, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And there's
I wanted to give the reader an idea of what it must have been like to be in Egypt in 350, 360 B.C., because the whole world didn't know anything about Egypt or could not even read Egyptian hieroglyphics until they were deciphered in 1822. And so all of that history was lost, except for the fact that there was this pharaoh named Necht-Anubis, which mm-hmm. that's his Greek name, turns up in the Irish invasion myths, which are oral myths that talk about their migration to the Irish Isles. And it seemed to me that it was impossible that this Irish cleric who wrote in Latin would have been able to even know the name of this Egyptian pharaoh in 350 B.C. I mean, it's actually impossible. So that means to me that the Irish myths have a lot of truth in them.
I thought that was intriguing, that an Egyptian princess actually founded Scotland.
Well, that's her name. According to the tribe was called the Scotti, and they took their name from their princess.
Right.
So, I mean, it is a myth, but on the other hand, if you look at the historical records that go right along with it, the majority of these myths seem to have a lot of truth in them, if not completely true.
That's right. That's right. So, they have their basis in reality.
How can the Stone of Scone, which is in Edinburgh Castle now, mm-hmm. how can it talk? The only way that a stone can talk, unless you believe in magic,
right.
Is if it has writing on it.
Right.
And so in the old days, that stone probably had Egyptian hieroglyphics all over it.
Right.
And which no one could read.
Right. Fascinating. And then by the time, or present day, even though the stone exists, the writing is not there anymore?
Well, yes, because of weathering.
Right.
But on the other hand, there's another story that when Edward Longshanks came to Scotland to steal all the artifacts, he actually thought he was an archaeologist, too. He dug up what he thought was King Arthur's grave and stole those artifacts. But he came to Scotland to take all the crown jewels and things that belonged to Scotland. And so there's a story that the monks hid the actual stone and kept it. And they gave him what was then the Privy Stone. And if you look at that stone, it has these copper handles on it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't look like something that would be a coronation stone at all. It looked like something that would cover a toilet. So I think it was a big joke that the Scots did on Edward I.
I like that.
So I researched an awful lot of legends. It turns out that this pharaoh, though, back in 360 B.C., was some sort of a magician. And the people really believed that he could be in two places at once.
Ah.
They thought that he could do kind of like a Darth Vader person, could control them. I mean, he could get his way with all mm-hmm. sorts of things. He had, of course, all these henchmen that would kill people. There's no way to know how he got to be the pharaoh because, obviously, he wasn't in the lineage of any other pharaoh.
Right.
But he disappears quite suddenly in the history books that Egypt has. And somehow they say he disappeared into the western desert. And then there are other stories that he was a fortune teller in Macedonia, which is that other weird myth that
yes.
he actually is the father of Alexander the Great.
Right.
There are statues and big edifices in Lebanon that show Nectanebus sitting with his son next to him, who is Alexander the Great. So in those ancient times, people believed all sorts of things about this pharaoh.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's so true.
So you have to kind of pull the threads and untangle everything to see what stories there are.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it jumps from modern times to these ancient times. So
yes.
It was just my way of telling the story.
Now, you're a harpist, correct?
Yes, I'm a harper.
A harper, is that how you say it?
Yes, the harpers play a folk instrument, and it nowadays has levers so I can play any key. It's basically a vertical piano.
Oh.
And it's wooden, and it's just a wonderful thing. I took up harping suddenly after retiring from my career as a special ed teacher. And people would ask me, well, where do harps come from? So I had to research that, Wren fairs and festivals, and say, I don't know. But it must have come across the Mediterranean because there are harps in Egypt and in Palestine area and in Syria, places like that. And then Mycenaean islands have statues of harpers, but nowhere in Europe. So that's the only place it could have come from.
Interesting. Well, what made you decide to take up the harp?
I went over to the central office to retire on the last day of July. So I went into the office and I said, I need to retire today. And the lady said, well, are you going to take a helicopter? And I said, what? And she said she needed to have the paperwork in by 5 o'clock and she needed my birth certificate and a bunch of stuff,
right.
forms filled out and a letter to the superintendent and all this. So by the time I got back to her office with those things in hand, it was 10 minutes to 5, and she got retired that day. And so when I came home from that, I walked in the front door, and my husband was sitting there, and I said, I'm retired. And he said, and I quote, what do you want to do now? And I said, I want to play the harp. And my dear, I have not had any music lessons or instrument lessons of any kind.
Oh, wow.
And so he said, well, I have a book of kits. We could build one. Obviously, as teachers, we didn't have money to go out and buy a harp. So mm-hmm. he built a harp for me.
Oh.
And then he said that I needed to sew up my fabric upstairs because it was a fire hazard, which it was. So then to the I did a medieval and Renaissance costume business.
Oh my.
And traveled all around to Ren fairs and Celtic festivals with my harp clothes.
And your costumes.
Yeah.
And that's and great.
So it turned out just wonderfully.
Yes, and that's how you, when you were doing all this, you were learning about the history.
Yeah.
That's, how exciting. That's a great story.
It's been a real trip, let me tell you. And
yes.
I have to tell you that when you write a book and you're immersed in this story for whatever, the 20 years I was.
Oh, yes.
Those characters don't get out of your head at night.
I mean, sure.
I was dreaming this lady and dreaming of my present-day archaeologist, and they still are in my head, and so there will be a sequel to this book.
Oh, good. Well, they're very real characters.
Thank you.
Yes, I got to know them, too, and I know how it is that characters take on a life of their own.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, do you have a few pages you want to read for us?
Well, I can read you our introduction to Donnie Cameron.
Great.
You don't get to know him until page 91, looks like. He'd been working at it for hours, dig a few inches, brush carefully through the sand, sift what was dug up, rinse, repeat. He was sweaty, his skin covered in a layer of ground-in sand he knew would take forever to wash off. But he didn't care. Donald Cameron was happy. This is what he wanted to be doing. If you asked him if he'd rather be on a beach, cold beer, and girls in bikinis all around, he'd say, nope. Donald sat back on his heels and mopped at his face with a cloth. It didn't do much more than spread the dirt around. He reconsidered the beer and bikinis. Nope, he was happiest digging in the dirt. That's how Donald Cameron is.
Yes, that's great.
Nothing else.
Yes. So tell me about the writing process of the book.
I think I dreamt most of it.
Oh.
At least the scenes and things that were in Egypt, I think I dreamt. And then I would wake up at 4:30 or 5 in the morning and write that down.
Oh, my.
As best I could, and then I would do my daily thing. I spent a lot of time writing in the wee hours of the morning, like 5 and 6 a.m., and then, you know, do whatever else I needed to do for the day. So
right.
It took me a year to write it.
Uh-huh.
And I did not use an editor because it seemed to me that an editor would be not happy with the way I wrote this book, jumping from ancient Egypt to modern times and back and forth. I thought that they would probably say that was not the way to do this book, and so I didn't use an editor.
But it works.
Thank you.
Yes.
I wasn't sure. Everyone who has read it, of course, if you look on Amazon, I have a lot of 5-star reviews. I have 2 4-star reviews, and that's it. I have trouble getting people to write reviews on Amazon. I don't know why, but I've sold several hundred books, and I've gotten a lot of really good feedback that, it was a great read. People are asking me to write the sequel, so I guess I am doing it.
Well, that tells you something.
Yeah, but I could not find an editor that, you know, wasn't too expensive for me, and I could not find an agent. I could not find a bookstore that would have it give me a book reading, for instance. And they were all interested in Southwestern things. They weren't interested in Egypt or Scottish things. So I just had to self-publish it.
Well, I'm glad you did.
And my nephew was kind enough to paint the cover.
I was wondering about the cover.
Well, he's an artist, and he lives in Los Angeles area. But he has done many, many covers for books. So it was an obvious thing for me to ask him to do it. The first time he did it, he had the harp backwards. But the strings backwards because he'd never really seen
one. Right. That makes sense. But it's a picture of Skota and her harp on the stone.
Mm-hmm. Yes. although the stone in his drawing is much larger than the thing that they have in Edinburgh Castle. But it does have some copper rings on it like
it
that.
It does, yes. And I really liked her. She was a very nice princess. I mean, she didn't, she had a lot of ladies in waiting, but all of them were her friends, she called them.
I had an idea that being so-called biracial, since her mother was not an Egyptian either, that she would have had a lot of trouble and related very well to the servant girls and, of course, was always looking for friendship. Her father was so frightening to her. She was being forced into a marriage with him, even though her father had other wives. He had not produced a son. And so she was being forced into marrying her father, which was done in Egyptian times. But she would have had to marry him when she was turned 16. And the alternative was, of course, to go into this more or less like a nunnery, these priestesses who never married and were, of course, celibate forever.
That is a custom that back then that the daughters would marry the father?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. And, or their brother.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it because you had to keep the line, the genetic
right.
line going. And, of course, Nectanebus was the usurper of the whole country in the first place.
Right.
And he could do whatever he wanted to do. But she luckily met this man. And this name, Gamal Meleth, is in the Irish invasion myths.
Oh.
He's called a Milesian, and in fact, I had some friends who were born in Ireland who were Irish, and this man told me, yes, my mother told me we were Milesians.
Oh.
So I suppose that if you were Irish and you lived in Ireland and grew up there, you might have been told you were a Milesian.
Oh, that's fascinating.
The stories are still with them, in other words.
And you have the little gang of the professor and the Egyptianologist and the girls, and they walk around, not Stonehenge, but another group of stones.
The stones are everywhere.
Really?
There are standing stone circles. You wouldn't think there would be some, but there are many of them in Spain, and of course, in northern France, and of course all over Ireland, and of course all over the Outer Hebrides. And if you have researched Skara Brae or any place in the Orkneys, there are many, many, many standing stone circles. Those people, these Neolithic, what they call Neolithic people, erected these huge stones all over the planet.
That's fascinating. And then the professor's sister lives really far north.
Yes, she lived in Lewis.
Right, yes. Right.
And the standing stones on Lewis are very well known. I actually visited there on New Year's Day. Well, actually, it was the solstice.
Oh, my
gosh.
And
it was so funny because I was staying at a hotel, obviously, and then I wanted to be at the stones at the solstice when the sun rose. So I walked over to the stones at Callanish, and there were all these hippie-type people in their pup tents, but they were asleep because they didn't realize that far north that the sun would be coming up.
Right.
At about 3 o'clock in the morning. It's so far north that the sun would go down at like 11 o'clock at night, and then it would come back up at about 3 or 3:30. Because, you just have to get the idea of being so far north that the sun is so different there. I mean, why they call it Roman in the gloaming. You don't get actual darkness at all.
Yeah, I was fascinated by that part of the country, too, that you captured. I mean, like I said, the book is rich in characters and places. They go all over. And so I can tell you've traveled many of these places.
Well, but see, I think that stone traveled. I think
right.
that stone came from Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
I think it stayed in Spain a while, and I think it went to Ireland. as the Lea Fail, the talking stone.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think it went over to Scotland as the Stone of Scone. And I think part of that stone is the Blarney Stone. Piece of it is in Blarney Castle. It's supposed to talk, but of course, you in the Blarney Castle, you only talk gibberish.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that's fascinating. And the scrolls that Donnie found.
Yes.
And was so careful to preserve. What were those? What did those consist of?
Well, that's my imagination.
Uh-huh.
I think that when Skoda was in Spain,
mm-hmm.
he must have left records of where they were going, because she knew there would be other people following after her.
Mm-hmm.
So I had her curl up these papyrus stories and put them in wax and save them in a jar for Donnie to find.
Right. It was perfect.
That's just my imagination.
Well, I like
that.
They've
never found any records, any written records of this princess in Egypt. It's a complete fabrication, according to all Egyptologists.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if it's a fabrication, how is it that the monks in Ireland knew the name of this pharaoh?
There's some connections that can't be denied there. Very interesting the way you described the court in Egypt. And I like the way that you had, the women were so strong. And Skoda herself was a warrior.
Yes, according to the Scots, she was their queen.
And
she supposedly was killed in Ireland in this invasion. And there was a place called Glen Skoheen
mm-hmm.
where she's supposed to be buried. But they have never excavated it.
Yeah,
she's like Boudicca's in my estimation.
Mm-hmm. She is.
She must have been. She had six sons in Spain.
Right.
So.
And then went back on the battlefield.
Yeah.
It was great. I really liked her.
One of her sons, Amergin, was called mm-hmm. the poet. And he wrote this wonderful Irish poetry. If you ever have a chance to look at it, it is just lyrical and beautiful poetry.
Oh, this is for real.
Oh, yeah, for real.
Okay. I get mixed up now.
Yeah, I know. It's because it's all real to me.
Right.
But there are copious amounts of Irish oral myths that have his actual poetry in them. He talks about the nine waves and all the blessing and all the Celtic gods and all their mythology.
Oh.
It's just really...
So you weren't a historian.
Oh, no.
This was just...
A teacher.
Wow. Did you used to tell stories?
Well, I made sure that all my students had some grasp of not only American history, but what they needed to know. I knew that the curriculum... See, I taught mostly behavior-disordered kids that had murdered or who had been in trouble with the law or, you know, had some reason to be in a special ed class, even though they were very intelligent. And so I wanted them to get more than just what was in the standard curriculum. So we did a lot of biographies of other people so that they would have an idea that, you know, even Wilma Rudolph had polio, but she could be a track star and things
right.
like that I did. So,
great.
So that they would have a grasp of making lemonade out of their lemon.
And had you been a writer before?
No.
This?
Well, just a dissertation, but that doesn't count.
Oh, that does count, believe me.
No, it doesn't. But no, I have never been a writer before, although I've been getting some successful stories written, short stories,
mm-hmm.
some satirical pieces, some science fiction pieces.
So. Oh, exciting.
Yeah, and I'm having fun.
And I read your piece about growing up in Los Alamos.
Oh, really? Well, yeah, it has not been published yet, but yeah.
Very interesting.
I have to tell you that was not a happy place to grow up. Did I tell you I had been injected with tritium?
No.
In kindergarten, the AEC took our whole kindergarten class to an army tent on Trinity Drive, had us line up boys and girls. They had actually brought one of the wooden kindergarten blocks from the school and put it there for us to put our right foot up on.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to give us an injection, and they gave us this kind of warm juice to drink. It came out of some cans, and it was probably pineapple juice or lemonade, but it was warm, and it was yellowish. And so my friend Bobby kicked the nurse in the shin because he thought she was having us drink urine. And so when we got up to the, we could hear, all the children were screaming because they were giving us this injection right above the knee. We had to put our foot up on this wooden block and get this injection right over the knee.
Oh, my gosh.
And then we had to stand around and wait. And then we had to urinate in the cup.
Oh, my gosh.
And, of course, the boys thought this was a lot of fun because they had the appropriate thing. They could pee into
a cup. It
was
much easier,
and the
yes.
girls, I mean, we were like, we have to squat over this cup and pee in a cup. And they, I mean, we're in kindergarten. We're 5 years old, right?
Oh.
And so they didn't have the place screened off or anything. I mean, it wasn't a bathroom. It was this tent. And they collected all this urine and put it in these big cans, you know, like you would see at a dairy, a big, tall aluminum can.
Oh my gosh.
I told the nurse it was a stupid experiment because you wouldn't be able to tell my pee-pee from anybody else's.
That's right.
And so later on in the Clinton administration, a lot of that stuff about human experimentation was being published. So I called up my father.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, did you allow them to inject me with something when I was in kindergarten? And he refused to answer.
Oh, wow.
I had to ask him several times. And finally he said, well, it was probably just low-level tritium.
Oh, my gosh.
And so there are four kids out of that kindergarten class that remember this happening.
Wow.
I mean, including myself.
Right.
I've talked with, because we have high school reunions every once, mm-hmm. you know, periodically, and I made sure I talked with every kid that was in my kindergarten class, and most of them don't remember it happening. But I do because it was very painful, and because my friend Bobby Albright kicked the nurse really badly in the shin, and she got this big goose egg on her shin.
Oh, my gosh.
And, of course, I grabbed him and took him aside, but
he
was the only one that wasn't a sheep. And as I think back on it now, that was the reason I went into special ed to teach the kids that were always in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was a kid that would jump off the swings or go down the slide head first or something, and he didn't get to graduate with our class. He left. He dropped out of school in Los Alamos, which is almost unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
And never didn't know what happened to him, but he didn't graduate with us. And he was just a little maverick, but that's the kind of kid that I liked
right.
to teach. And so
right.
I spent 30 years doing that.
That's great. All these stories you just said would be great to write
well,
out.
Well, I know. It's
you
kind
know?
Of frightening.
Yes, that's just
there
it.
Are more, Tracy.
All right. Well, I hope to read them, and I hope to read the sequel to Skoda's story. And we're just about out of time.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. So do you have anything you want to add, Michelle?
No, I just want to thank you profusely for allowing me to have an interview. As I said, I couldn't find any way to publicize this book except on Amazon. And I would ask the listeners if they do read the book, if they would please give me a review. There's some urban myth that says if you give 50 reviews, something magical happens. I have 33.
Oh, that's close.
And I would like people to honestly review it. I'm not asking for perfection here. I just would like some more reviews.
Yes. That's always a good idea, listeners.
From you, too.
Right. To put in a review. Absolutely.
Yes. It helps. It really
it does
help.
It does. Well, all right, then. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And that was Michelle Buchanan talking about her book, Skoda's Harp, History of Egypt and Ireland and all kinds of good things. This is Tracy Hales-Vass, right on Four Corners on KSJE 90.9 FM, Farmington, New Mexico.